The China and Africa podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Africa-China Reporting Project at Wits University in Johannesburg. The ACRP promotes balanced, considered reporting on Africa-China relations through innovative training programs held throughout the year. More information at africachinareporting.co.za.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the China in Africa podcast. I'm Eric Olander. And as always, I'm joined by Kobus van Staden, a senior China-Africa researcher at the South African Institute of International Affairs in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good afternoon to you, Kobus.
Good afternoon.
Kobus, it was a very busy week in the corporate front in the China-Africa space. And one of the top stories that we covered a lot for our newsletter subscribers, those who subscribed to our premium service on China-Africa Project this past week, was a Series A round investment led by two Chinese venture capital firms into what's being called the Uber for trucks in Africa. And this was a really interesting fundraise because we're starting to see more venture capital interest from China coming into places like Africa as the United States now becomes closed and, as the Wall Street Journal called Chinese VC money, toxic. So that money now has to look for to be used somewhere else. And some of it is now finding its way into African early stage companies. And that was so interesting. And I think what it kind of opened the door for us and what some of the analysis that we did was it shows you the diversity and the dynamism now of China's private sector engagement in Africa, which is really starting to pick up. And what's interesting, Kobus, is that when you were in Japan this summer for the TCAD 7 summit, it was one of the outcomes of that summit was the fact that the Japanese private sector is going to be much more engaged in Africa. That was also the message coming from the Americans as well out of Prosper Africa. The Chinese, for their part, have not articulated that in any policy framework like the Americans and the Japanese have. But it does seem to be happening nonetheless in so many different ways, particularly in places like Rwanda and Ethiopia, where there is a lot of private sector engagement.
Yes, I think I would actually go further than you and say that despite the fact that the Americans and the Japanese and the Europeans increasingly talk a big game about private sector investment in Africa, but what you find is that both in the case of the Europeans and the Japanese, that the companies that tend to do a lot of business in Africa now are ones that have already had a presence in Africa for a while. Like companies like Toyota, for example, who assemble in South Africa. It's harder than these governments want to admit to get these companies to make fresh investments in Africa or to get new companies to make fresh investments in Africa. There's a lot of wariness of Africa. And on the other hand, while the Chinese don't necessarily have this kind of very, very developed kind of set of policies to get the private sector into Africa, the Chinese private sector is going to Africa anyway. And in a lot of ways, they're jumping into market gaps that these more risk-averse American, Japanese, and European companies end up missing the boat on.
And one great example of that, and this is, again, a very important milestone for 2019, is Transsyn Holdings. That's the Shenzhen-based mobile phone company that has brands like Infinix and Tecno, which a lot of people know a lot about. They did an initial public offering in Shanghai with a business based primarily on African sales and generated $7 billion valuation out of that IPO. That's from an African business. That is private sector-led investment. Huawei being another one, StarTimes. These are all very dynamic private sector companies. Of course, there is some linkage with the Chinese government. There are oftentimes loans that are used, and there is always a little bit of a connection, but it is very fair to characterize these as private sector companies. Now, the problem is when we talk about Chinese and companies, two words that oftentimes get confused in the lexicon, they seem rather simple, but they actually are complicated terms. And we're going to break that down today, looking specifically at the case in Ethiopia. And we are so thrilled to have on the program for the first time Weiwei Chen, who joins us from Helsinki. Weiwei is a PhD candidate in development studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, where she's doing her PhD. She's also a PhD fellow at the UNU WIDER, which is a think tank for the United Nations based in Helsinki, Finland. She joins us from a very chilly Helsinki. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us, Weiwei.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be invited.
It's a pleasure to have you on the program. You are among a group of scholars who are looking at Chinese engagement in Ethiopia. Ethiopia, for its part, is now one of the epicenters of the more dynamic commercial activity of the Chinese. And I would put Rwanda also on that list. It's interesting because the most dynamic places in Africa for business are really the resource-poor countries, not the resource-rich countries. We're not seeing the same activity in places like Angola or Nigeria, but it is hot in Kenya, in certainly Rwanda, and also in Ethiopia. So I'd like to start with a very general question that you write about quite a bit, about the stark contrast that can be seen between the Chinese state and private capital in Africa. And for outsiders, and maybe even Chinese themselves, this is a distinction that can become very confusing because oftentimes when people think of Chinese investment in Africa, it's predominantly by state-owned enterprises, things like Sinohydro, China Resources. These are these big state-owned enterprises. Talk to us a little bit about the research that you have done in Kenya and who some of the actors are, and if you can break down those words of Chinese and companies and what they mean.
Well, thank you, Eric. China has become actually Ethiopia's largest investor, trade partner, and engineering contract in recent years. However, a stark contrast can be seen between the state and the private firms. Well, state-owned enterprise is mainly concentrated in construction sector. And it is striking to see that the manufacturing sector predominant by the private sector. According to the secondary data I collected from Ethiopia Investment Commission, it is interesting to see that around 78.65% of the Chinese OFDI in the past two decades actually is from the manufacturing sector. And predominantly, it is the private sector who are the main player of this industry. According to one MOFCOM official, he mentioned that there is around 95% of the total number of Chinese firms in Ethiopia actually is from the private sector. However, this number haven't included two certain groups. The first one is those private firms didn't register with the MOFCOM because it's not mandatory. Secondly, it was those who we call the translocal companies. For those who didn't have mother company or business in China, invested there because of the great opportunity. So taking this into consideration, it is striking to see that Chinese private firms, you can see the presence of Chinese private firms in Ethiopia, and particularly in the manufacturing sector.
And so when we're talking about the manufacturing sector, what kind of manufacturing are they mostly doing? And then secondly, do you have an impression of whether for the majority of these firms, is this their first African investment, or are some a number of them already invested in other African countries or other African sectors?
Well, it's unlike SOEs, state-owned enterprises, it's very challenging to track those Chinese private firms in Ethiopia. I can provide some examples based on the firms I observed. Because in Ethiopia, I spent 6 months in the Eastern Industry Park. There are around 86 firms until June last year. There was around 86 firms in the Eastern Industry Park. And 79 out of 86 are Chinese firms. And 78 out of 79 are private firms. And it is interesting to see that the early investors, that is, mean the investor came to Ethiopia between 2008 and 2013. Those firms mainly focuses on the light manufacturing industry for low-end products, for example, the plastic sleepers, textile garments, and sell in the domestic market. Increasingly, they have some large-scale labor-intensive, export-oriented firms start their investment in Ethiopia. And Huajin was the very first firm that invited by the Ethiopian government to relocate their industrial capital in Ethiopia and focus on 100% exports to the U.S. and the European market. Increasingly, especially after 2015, there are new variety of Chinese private firms start investment in Ethiopia. And some of them already publicly listed firms in China have very good reputation and have very mature relations with the global buyers. And you can see that the Chinese private investment has become more diverse. It is fluid and always ongoing.
You mentioned Huajian, and for those people not familiar with Huajian, it's one of the largest shoe manufacturers in the world. And they, about 10 years ago, led in part by Helen Hai, who we've interviewed on the show before, set up a large shoe manufacturing operation in Ethiopia, and in many ways has become the case study for Chinese manufacturing in Africa. And everybody points to Huajian. You know, it's funny because over the past 10 years since Huajian showed up in Ethiopia and set up its operations, people keep saying, well, the industrialization is coming. It's coming. And they keep pointing to Huajian as the example. But yet we really haven't seen the growth of industrialization manufacturing in terms of what we expected. Let me read you a quote from Howard French. And Howard French is, for those of you not familiar, author of China's Second Continent. He's an adjunct professor or an assistant professor at Columbia University Journalism School, very well known in the China-Africa space, very well-respected journalist. And he recently wrote in his World Politics Review column a comment that I'd like to get your take on. Quote, "Some commentators also pretend that China is in the process of industrializing Africa. This is largely a fantasy and an unhealthy one because it makes space for magical thinking about the continent's problems and thereby avoids serious focus on the daunting challenges at hand." He goes on to say, "Through no real fault of its own, China is mostly an obstacle to African industrialization. That's because China industrialized decades ago and now dominates with overwhelming advantages of scale most of the sectors that newly industrialized economies like those in Africa seek to enter." So we think of shoe manufacturing, textiles, mobile phone production. These are all the light manufacturing types of industries that Africa hopes to be able to rise. And Howard French makes the point that they would then be rising and competing directly with the Chinese. So question number one is, what do you think of Howard French's comment? And question number two is, I'd like to get your take on whether or not you are part of the group that sees this migration of Chinese outsourced manufacturing to places like Africa with what we see here in Southeast Asia.
Well, I think French's comment is, to me personally, I kind of disagree with that based on my empirical evidence. And firstly, I think Huajian's investment to Ethiopia is a combination of industrial relocation and some kind of strategic South-South cooperation. And because the motive of firms going out is diverse, and it's a combination of many factors, not only about the industrialization in African countries, obviously, as a private firm, it won't take this as the primary interest to invest abroad. And according to my interviews and the participation observation on the ground, I found that Huajian is an interesting case. On the one hand, its investment was invited by the then Prime Minister Meles Zenawi. And on the other hand, it was supported by the Guangdong provincial government and Huajian's buyers from the global north. And Huajian's going out was not, it's quite a unique case to showcase that a successful demonstration effort for Ethiopia to attract labor-intensive export-oriented industry and to showcase the world that industry like this can be received in Ethiopia. But this is the starting point that the Ethiopian government showcased that their interest to attract this kind of investment. But increasingly, I want to argue that is the host country government is reaction is not a single way. They are evolving, learning by doing the process. And increasingly, you can see from the Hawassa Industry Park, Ethiopia government attract the whole PVH, the whole supply chain to move into the Ethiopia. And increasingly, it's not about one single company, but increasingly they want to diversify the learning from the previous experience and to increase, adjust their industrial policy to make sure that those kind of foreign investment is in line with Ethiopia's national strategy. It's not about foreign investors' interest only. It is about the interest of the host country government. They are playing a more bolder role. As I remember that Justin, this is a political economist from the Cambridge University, he argues that increasingly Ethiopia play a role of carrot and stick industrial policy, but Ethiopia plays more carrot than the stick. But I argue that increasingly Ethiopia government play the stick their border to play with stick, but it is bespoken to certain sectors and certain firms. And how they, the interesting phenomenon is you can see that how they govern the existing investors and how they change their government policy to make them to enhance their, for instance, the management and enhance their working condition for the local workers and ask them to export more. This is interesting to see that, yeah, this is progressive.
So, you know, just to unpack that a little bit more, when we a few years ago, we interviewed Helen Hai, who started the Huajian shoe factory. And she was, you know, we asked her what kind of problems she had in setting up the factory. And she mentioned instances of, for example, shipments of components that were stuck in customs that, you know, kind of, and we asked her, so how, you know, how do you overcome such problems? And she was like, well, you know, you just call the minister and then the minister sorts it out for you. You know, which was an interesting kind of snapshot of doing business in Ethiopia at that moment. So, as you mentioned, you know, kind of the Ethiopian government has this set of tools that they can deal with some inducements and enticements and some kind of rules and, you know, enforcement. What is the relationship now between the Ethiopian government and these kind of Chinese elites that set up these factories? And like, how has the Ethiopian government's approach, you know, evolved over time?
I haven't really asked about this question about whether, like, wherever they encounter problems, they just call the prime minister or not. But I found through the entire field work, I found the process of formalization of institutional networks, especially for the Chinese institutional mechanism between the host country government, it has been evolving. And for instance, not Huajian, but the Eastern Industry Park, at very beginning, they received great support from, informal great support from the Ethiopian government. But now they institutionalize their business institution mechanism, and they register an association under the Ethiopian Investment Commission. This is called Eastern Industry Zone Investor Association. This has been officially recognized by the Ethiopian government, and by doing so, they have their own protocol to govern the tenants and investors and developers within the industry park. And increasingly, they have regular meeting with the host country government and the line ministers. So this is the process that you can see. This has been institutionalized. It has been formalized. This is also show the way that Chinese private investors, they are learning. They see the success of other industry park, for example, the Hawassa industry park. So they learn from their successful experience or what Ethiopian government want them to do. So they set up this kind of formal institute to bargain, to negotiate with host country government. This kind of relation is more stable. And as a return, they have the regular meeting with the host country government, and the EIC collect feedback from them regarding about their daily constraints they encountered, whether and start investigation with the broad stakeholders, not only the investor, but also the local community and labor. So this kind of mechanism help to sustain this kind of sustainable, this smooth business environment climate. And I think it's a progressive one, but it's not, I'm not sure that it happened in Huajian, but it is happening for the Eastern Industry Park community.
Support for this podcast comes from the Africa China Reporting Project at Wits University School of Journalism in Johannesburg. The ACRP provides reporting grants, workshops, and other professional development opportunities for both African and Chinese journalists. Follow the ACRP on Twitter at @WitsChinaAfrica or visit africachinareporting.co.za for information about grants and upcoming seminars.
I'd like to understand a little bit more about who these Chinese companies are and why they've come to Ethiopia, according to your research. Again, are they producing products for the domestic Ethiopian market and maybe for sale in Africa? Are they producing for export to Europe and the free trade access they may get there? Or I'm not sure if, I think Ethiopia is an AGOA country, so it gets duty-free access into the United States. Or, as we talked about earlier, and as maybe Howard French alluded to, is this part of the migration out of China and this Ethiopia is picking up the same type of business that Vietnam And Southeast Asia is picking up, which is the costs of producing and manufacturing in China have gone up. Labor costs, environmental regulations, all those different factors combined to the point where someone making flip-flops can't make a profit in China but goes to Ethiopia and can. So tell us a little bit about the motivations of these different companies that you've spoken with when you're in Ethiopia.
Yeah, well, my research focuses about the light manufacturing industry and the construction material industry. So I try to explore the motives and the determinants for those kind of firms to invest in Ethiopia. And the finding finds is very diverse. And the motivations for firms, for example, some firms, they came to Ethiopia because they have long-term trade relation with Ethiopian clients in EU, for this kind of city is famous for the commodity trading. So their investment to Ethiopia is to be geographically proximity to the host, the final destination, that is Ethiopian domestic market. And some firms went to Ethiopia was because of the access to the international market, that, as you say, the AGOA and the everything but ARM. These preferential policies are very attractive to certain firms, such as Huatian. Because when I ask Huatian, what if you choose one single most important determinant for you to decide to invest in Ethiopia rather than other African country? And the answer is that is the AGOA and the everything but arms. Other factors are of great importance, but this is the most important factor. And but for increasingly for other firms, it shows the diverse case. For instance, the JPTE, Wuxi Jingmao from Hawassa Industry Park, their investment to Ethiopia was partially driven by their global buyer, that is Hawassa, that is PVH Group, and was partially also invited by the Ethiopian government. But as I asked the same questions, what is the most determinant? And they said it is the market expansion they want to achieve, because PVH is one of the important clients to them, but it's not the only client. By taking advantage of the access to the international market in Ethiopia, they can expand with other European clients or American clients. So this is their most important determinant. And apart from this, in one publicly listed firm from Jiangyin, that is called Jiangsu Sunshine. It is a very well-known firm for woolen textile. This firm didn't go out at an early stage where other low-end textile garment firms relocated their industrial capital. Was because this is has very mature clients in China and in international markets. And their relocation to Ethiopia, if I ask them the single reason, that is because of increasing labor production costs in China. But this industry can no longer make profit that much in China. So AGOA and the everything for arms, this is important. But to them, even if Ethiopia doesn't have AGOA and EBN, EBAs, they still will choose Ethiopia because of potential of the labor, trainable labor there and the access to the land and everything. So it is interesting to see such dynamics.
So speaking of low labor costs, I recently saw a headline that Ethiopian garment workers are some of the lowest paid in the world, like that wages in Ethiopian garment in the sector is lower than in Bangladesh, for example. So I'm not sure whether that's 100% accurate, but I was wondering if you could give us an outline of what is the labor situation there, like what do the wages look like, and also whether there's any kind of labor organizing happening.
Yeah, the controversial thing in Ethiopia is there is no minimum wage there. So this make not only foreign investors, but also all kind of international organizations confused. What is the minimum? What is the wage that should be paid to the local workers? And when we conduct that research with the Chinese, to compare with Chinese firms, non-Chinese foreign firms and local firms, and we found all those leading firms, they pay much higher wages than the average, like poverty wage that's supposed to be, but we don't know the minimum wage. And it is also important to see that for different sectors, the wage will be significantly different. For instance, for the workers in the construction sector or workers in the manufacturing sector, their baseline will be different. So it is very difficult for the investors or for those firms to decide how much to pay. They only can know, okay, what is maybe the market pay for the average? Then they can decide based on this. So when for the project we conducted, we found that Chinese firms pay, there is no significant difference in terms of the wage if you get rid of the other factors such as location and the tenure of workers. But still, I think minimum wage is still a very important thing that the host country government really need to think about.
Well, let's focus a little bit more on this research that you did, and you alluded to it in your answer there. You did a research project with your SOAS colleague, Professor Carlos mm-hmm. Oya, which got a lot of attention earlier this year. And let me just read a key finding from this and have you talk a little bit about, because the Chinese, when it comes to the perception of how they treat workers, is really, it has not advanced, I'd say, in the past 15 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, you ask the average person on the street, they will tell you, still, China imports prison workers. They abuse workers. They only have Chinese people working on their projects. I mean, the misperceptions are far and wide, and they run very, very deep. Your project with Professor Oya tried to address some of these. Here's one of the findings. One of the common perceptions of Chinese firms working in Africa is that they do not employ locals. The working conditions are exploitative and that they don't contribute to skills development. However, and this is both your findings, our findings after 4 years of research have drawn up a very different picture. In Ethiopia, these mm-hmm. rates were 90% of all workers and 100% of low-skilled workers. And in Angola, where rates are usually much lower due to skill shortages, estimated rates were 74%. Okay, so the numbers, the facts, the empirical data that you thrive with says that the Chinese hire more locals. That's number one. How do they do on wages? You say they're comparable. They're still low, but they're comparable. So let's talk about these perceptions. Where do they come from? If in fact this is the case, that 100% of low-skilled workers in Ethiopia at Chinese firms are in fact local, they're not foreign, where is the gap?
Well, I think probably the gap there is the median management level and the skilled workers, because it's difficult to find skilled worker in certain sectors. Plus, if some certain sectors need to, for example, export-oriented or operate machinery that the host country government, the host country doesn't really have this kind of skills. So I assume the gap there is about medium management level and the professional or skilled workers there.
But that skilled worker is the same for a Turkish company, a British company, an American company. I mean, every foreign company faces the same issue of skilled labor and without skilled labor. In fact, I was working in China as part of for many years because they didn't have my skill set in China. I mean, this is very common internationally where people work. And I guess I wonder why the perceptions are so endurable. And you say it's because of media and communications and that China's just not communicating and it's misunderstood because of that. But the reality is that China is facing the same problem that all other international companies have in Ethiopia.
And I think because of the road projects that in the construction sector, some of them have been in the remote area. Plus, Chinese construction company have more projects than other non-Chinese firms. And according to Christina Wolf, and it's around, I think it's around 26 out of 35 projects in 2017 were conducted by the Chinese firms. So you can imagine how many local workers they employ and how many skilled workers you can find in that area. And plus in Ethiopia, the local politics is of great importance in certain areas that you cannot maybe employ a certain worker from another region. So this creates the challenge for those contractors to hire local employees.
Kobus, let me turn the question to you because you are a media scholar and you have been following this labor issue for as long as we've been doing this podcast for a decade now. Is it, in your opinion, just a question of communications and media management, or is it rooted in the fact that people like Michael Sata from Zambia, the former president, he was very, very, you know, aggressive in this idea of not having Chinese push wheelbarrows. That was his phrase, and using local labor. And the Chinese did bring in their own labor early on in their engagement in Africa. Is it just because those stereotypes from the mid-2000s are still with us today? Or is it, as you think, as Wei Wei was saying, a question of media and communications and just public perception? What's your thinking behind it?
I think it's kind of both, you know, and like media, you know, media perceptions is obviously an important part of it, among others, because I think there isn't that much media incentive to particularly dig into this issue frequently, unless there's a juicy story which can play to African audiences, which is that, you know, all of these foreigners are here and they're not creating any jobs. You know, so that is the kind of eyeball grabbing kind of version or framing of the story that tends to, I think, have a certain weight because journalists know it will get an audience. But I think there's also, you know, there's a lot of political capital kind of running on the back of this narrative. You know, kind of it makes it a very useful narrative for, especially for people like opposition politicians. Because it becomes a way of using China as a stick to beat your incumbent, you know, the incumbents you're trying to defeat in local elections. So I think there is a lot of kind of vested interests in African societies that keep that narrative alive, mixed with a lack of lack of transparency and a lack of a move, I think, frequently from Chinese companies to try and dispel the myth proactively. You know, so I think those two kind of conflate. Relating to that, you mentioned briefly that that they frequently have difficulties dealing with local politics. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of like what that entails? Like what kind of local pressures are on these companies, and who are some of these local actors that they have to deal with?
Well, for instance, if workers from, for example, Tigrayan region, and I don't know, just an example, like workers from this Tigrayan state and move to with the Chinese company to Oromia state to work there, it might potentially say, oh, you are not from this regional state. So within certain distance, we have to hire local workers. So this is a kind of challenge maybe for the construction company. For the manufacturing firms, they prefer to hire people in the surrounding areas. So if people from like southern state and want to work in Oromia state, it will be very difficult. It might potentially create problems. This has happened in early last year in certain companies I observed.
And so would those kind of divisions between, say, you're from a southern state and you want to work in the northern state, does that become difficult in terms of for example, documents, you know, internal travel documents, whether it works in China sometimes, where it's difficult to move from one area to a big city, for example? Or is it more a situation of people looking different, speaking different, you know, that ethnic and linguistic differences lead to forms of discrimination by fellow workers?
I think it's a combination of both, but partially for instance, the one factory I observed, it was because certain workers here, actually they were born in southern state. There was the reason that because of the political context in that region, they tried to get rid of those people in the factory that created the problem. It was because of the ethnic, I think.
This summer I was in Beijing and I spoke with... I spoke with somebody, and he worked with the Chinese. Let me just phrase this so I don't reveal his identity. He was seconded to the Ethiopian government to help the Ethiopian government better manage how it engages with China. And one of the things that he learned from that experience of spending 1 to 2 years inside the Ethiopian government working was that Chinese businesses were complaining bitterly about the level of corruption and bribes that they were being asked to be paid by Ethiopian government officials, and that they felt that a lot of Chinese businesses felt that they were being singled out by the Ethiopian government, both in terms of paying higher taxes, but also for bribes and whatnot. I'm curious just to see if your research revealed some of that frustration that this individual found when he was working inside the Ethiopian government and when he was talking to Chinese private business owners in Ethiopia.
Well, yeah, it's quite controversial, but from my observation, sometimes I can see the complaints about the high bureaucracy, especially at the local government level, that companies didn't get the service they want. Instead, the local government came to them not for the sake of providing service, asked for the constraints that firms encounter so they can remove those kind of binding constraints. Instead, they went there for the sake of donation. This would happen, and it was narrated in my chapter as well. And I think it's occasionally happened, but I think now because the Prime Minister, Dr. Abiy, that take power since last year, I think lots of government officials, those kind of people, have been changed. I don't know the current situation, but it is interesting to observe.
Well, Weiwei Chen is a PhD candidate in development studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, also a PhD fellow at UNU Wider, which is a think tank for the United Nations in Helsinki. For the first time, we've had a guest from Helsinki. How exciting. So we are thrilled to have... It's very cold. You'd rather be in Ethiopia doing your research where it's a little bit warmer, I imagine.
Yeah, I love Ethiopia. It's sunny all the time.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating to have you on the show. The research that you and Carlos Oya have done is revealing, and it's so important because it challenges these perceptions. I spend my whole day on social media, and time and time again, people are saying one thing or another that is not correct, and I just fire off a link to your research, and it shuts the debate down right there. So what you do really has made an impact. And so I hope you'll pass that on to Professor Oya, who, by the way, we are also eager to have on the show to talk about the research that he's been doing. Weiwei, are you on social media anywhere if people want to get in touch with you?
Yes, sure. I'm on Twitter, but I don't really share that much on WeChat because Twitter is more about the sharing academic things, my recent work. But I'm going to create my own blog later to update all the informations and some of the narratives that I did conducted in Ethiopia so I can share to broad audience, not only academics.
Oh, well, that's you're speaking our language right there, too. So we don't like to be in academic land. So we're very excited about your blog. We will, of course, share links to all of your writing on your blog. Anytime Weiwei publishes something that's interesting relevant to China, Africa, we also share it on our various social media channels. So we're big Weiwei fans, and we're really thankful that you took the time to join us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's my honor to join you today.
Kobus, it's so refreshing to hear Weiwei's voice on these issues, in part because I've been reading her research for quite some time, and to see that the gap between the reality and the perceptions is still incredibly wide. And when they talk about the fact that 90%, 100% of local labor in places like Ethiopia are locally hired, it brings me up to the point that maybe the perceptions are being fed in part by social media. And English language social media, for example, in Africa is not confined to simply one country. So when the Kenya kind of standard gauge railway runs into labor issues, as they did last year, that's picked up across Anglophone Africa. And it's kind of defies boundaries. And that may be one way a lot of these misperceptions continue to kind of take hold across Africa, because the data and the facts have not been there for a long time to support this labor question, that the Chinese bring in their own workers to work on projects. We had Barry Soutman and Yen Hai-Rong, two professors from Hong Kong, who also did research on this. And maybe what we interviewed them 7-8 years ago, and they said the same thing. It was upwards of 85-90%. So this is not a new phenomenon, but yet it is persistent. And I might add, it's not just persistent in Africa. It's also persistent among China's critics in the West as well.
Yeah, very much. I mean, it's pushed by, you know, kind of by critics in the West frequently. And it's frequently presented as this thing that everyone knows. You know, this is, it's kind of like, oh, everyone knows that the Chinese bring their own laborers, which, you know, so it becomes part of the kind of intellectual furniture. You know, it just, you know, it's difficult to get rid of because it's frequently framed as this kind of, you know, thing that's so obvious that you almost don't need to say it, you know, which is very, very kind of insidious.
We didn't go as much into detail on the diversity of Chinese private actors and the private sector engagement there. And again, it's another one of these areas where I don't think the Chinese get as much credit as they deserve. Because when we talk about private sector, I think the Americans oftentimes have an instant association with it. We don't have state-owned enterprises the same way that the Chinese do. And so when we talk about private sector companies, oftentimes, I think we get the benefit of the doubt. And as you talked about and mentioned, I think is an excellent point, that a lot of the American rhetoric at this point is still theoretical. It's promises. It's not actually on the ground. Again, I put out on Twitter after the Transin IPO, I said, I'm curious, and I'm not trolling here. I'm genuinely curious if there's an American or European company that has IPO'd off of an African business the way that Transin did. And nobody came back with anything. Everybody talked about, as you talked about, the legacy companies. Companies like General Electric have done a lot of business in Africa for many, many years. A lot of resource extraction Coca-Cola. Companies. Mm. But have we seen young, new companies from the United States and Europe come into Africa the same way that we're seeing young companies come from China into Africa? Again, I need to put a disclaimer out there. I'm not supporting or advocating or endorsing with the Chinese here, trying to take a side. But at the end of the day, I do think it's more complicated than a lot of people make it out to be because of the dominance of the discussion around state-owned enterprises that overshadows the private sector companies.
Yes, no, I completely agree. And that it also then, you know, focus on state-owned enterprises tends to then flatten the complexity of the engagement as well, you know, because private sector companies work in different sectors. And they work on a lot, a wide range of sectors. This is what I find a little bit frustrating about the discourse about will China industrialize Africa or not industrialize Africa that you mentioned earlier. Because, you know, even, that seems to assume a kind of either or situation where either China is instituting some kind of continent wide, like massive industrialization project or nothing. You know, whereas it seems to me it's a more complicated situation where certain Chinese firms are manufacturing in Africa, and that does have some kind of like spillovers in terms of labor and wages and so on. But it all, you know, and they might kick off other forms of like smaller SME kind of industrialization, you know, like parts component manufacture or plastic bag manufacture, whatever. But it also, you know, they also kick off a host of other initiatives in the service industry. They kick off innovations in policy. You know, they allow local governments and urban governments to set up more fine-grained, you know, kind of ways of doing business, which all seems conducive and pushing towards, you know, kind of more African industrialization. You know, kind of there's mechanisms being set up that will then be possible to use for African companies too. You know, this kind of like either China really is industrializing Africa or not, kind of that kind of hard distinction makes no sense to me.
So the flip side of Howard French's comments about the fantasy or the magical fantasy of China industrializing Africa. And I must apologize, he's not an adjunct. I think he's an assistant already. If Howard French...
Yeah, this is a big gap, a bit different.
He's going to hate me even more now. Oh, God. So apologies, Howard, for that. That was not intentional. But nonetheless, the flip side of that is Irene Yuan Sun. You remember we spoke with her. She was on the McKinsey Company team that did the study that there are 10,000 Chinese companies currently in Africa. And so I really refer people to look up Irene Yuan Sun. She's now a fellow at the Center for Global Development. She's very much an advocate of what Weiwei was talking about in terms of the kind of this light manufacturing that's coming in and the diversity of Chinese actors in the private sector space. Let's also go back to the top of the show as well in the venture capital space. I think we're going to see a lot more Chinese money coming in. This is really important, in part because African startups and early stage companies are capital starved. Not a lot of people in the US or in Europe have the appetite for risk to invest in African startups. This is the same problem we have here in Southeast Asia as well. Hill House Capital and Crystal Stream were two really, you know, give them credit for going out there onto the frontier and looking into seeing these companies. Let me read you a quote from Wang Mengqiu, who is the founding partner of Crystal Stream. She says, "We think that infrastructure-related technology, such as informalized logistics platforms, is one of the most important cornerstones of the business development in Africa." And that's very interesting. So we might see, Cobus, private money start to follow where the Chinese have existing competitive advantages, namely in infrastructure. That would make a lot of sense. So transportation, mobility, things like that, they've already built in Africa. You might see Chinese money come into that. Also look into the aviation sector, where the Chinese are rebuilding a lot of the air traffic controls. Also, we're going to start seeing more Chinese jets coming into it. So private capital might start building on Chinese state-built infrastructure. That might actually play together very interestingly in the years to come. Final thoughts from you, Cobus?
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely a trend to look at. It I agree with you. It makes a lot of economic sense, and it'll be very interesting to see how it expands. Of course, it'll also have a lot of, I think, positive political will from African side. You know, there's African governments are obsessed frequently with issues of transportation. And freight logistics, because in many African countries, it presents such bottlenecks to development. So yeah, it's very, very worth keeping track of that, I think.
And in many parts of China that are still a developing country status, not all of China's that way, but these are problems they've dealt with themselves. So they might just be exporting the solutions from their own environment to places like Africa, or they're learning about it in other parts of the world and they're going to bring it into Africa as well. If you are in the China watching space or in the Africa watching space or an African scholar or in the analyst, and a lot of our listeners are in that professional space, you will want to subscribe to our newsletter. This is really a professional grade newsletter. These are the topics we deep dive on every single day. In fact, just today, I spent the past 2 or 3 hours talking about the latest flare up in US-China. Kind of tit for tat, and they're swiping at each other over Huawei, and the African Union was caught right in the middle and kind of did a TikTok story on all the different quotes. It was a deep dive. Again, if you're just a passive observer or a casual observer, our newsletter and our subscription is not for you. But if you do this for a living, or you are passionate about this subject, or you are really following what's happening in Africa, and for the life of me, Cobus, I can't understand people who do Africa studies for a living and don't dedicate themselves to understanding the Chinese engagement in it. It just makes no sense. I mean, I'm baffled by it, because China in so many ways is the transformative force in so many different sectors in Africa. And there just isn't a lot of information out there. So we're putting our pitch out there to say, if you are in the Africa space and you want something that's impartial and what we would call in our fair United States, fair and balanced, I think, can we reclaim that at some point?
Someone has.
Fox News doesn't get to have that forever. I mean, that's so. So go to our website, ChinaAfricaProject.com/subscribe. If you enter the promo code podcast, you will we'll give you a free month and just to try it out. And if you don't like it, you can go away. I've had a couple people already this month. They've tried it and then they said it wasn't for them. So they canceled. But I love that, because I love the fact that people are trying it on for size. So, and again, you can call me or email me anytime, eric@ChinaAfricaProject.com. We're very accessible. So if you have any questions about the subscription, the podcast, the newsletter, or you just want to talk, let me know. We'd love to speak with folks. So that'll do it for this edition of the China and Africa podcast. For Cobus van Staden in Johannesburg, I'm Eric Olander. Thank you so much for listening.
The discussion continues online. Head over to facebook.com/ChinaAfricaProject to share your thoughts on today's show. The guys are also on Twitter, where you can find Cobus @Stadinsky or Eric @EOlander. And be sure to sign up for the weekly China and Africa email newsletter by going to www.ChinaAfricaProject.com.